He looked back to the board and stared at the position. Then he said, "Shit." He did not turn over his king or offer to shake Beth's hand. He got up from the table and walked away, jamming his hands into his pockets. Beth took her pencil and circled Harmon on her score sheet. When she left at 10 o'clock, there were 3 names on the undefeated list. Harmon was still at the bottom. Beltic was still at the top. In her room that night, she could not get to sleep because of the way the games kept playing themselves over and over in her head long after she had stopped enjoying them. After several hours of this, she got out of bed and in her blue pajamas walked over to the dormer windows. She raised a shade and looked out at the newly bare trees by the light of the street lamp and at the dark houses beyond the trees. The street was silent and empty. There was a sliver of a moon, partly obscured by clouds. The air was chilly. Beth had learned not to believe in God during her time in Methuen's chapel, and she never prayed. But now she said, under her breath, "Please, God, let me play Beltic and checkmate him." In her desk drawer, in the toothbrush holder, were 17 green pills, and there were more in a little box on her closet shelf. She had thought earlier about taking 2 of them to help her doze off, but she did not. She went back to bed, exhausted now and her mind blank, and slept soundly. On Saturday morning, she had hoped to be playing someone with a rating over 1800. The man at registration had said there were 3 who were that high. But on the pairings, she was shown playing black against someone named Towns, with a rating of 1724. That was lower than her last game, the evening before. She went to the desk and asked about it.
"That's the breaks, Harmon," the man in the white shirt said. "Consider yourself lucky."
"I want to play the best," Beth said.
"You have to get a rating before that happens," the young man said.
"How do I get a rating?"
"You play 30 games in USCF tournaments and then wait 4 months. That's how you get a rating."
"That's too long." The man leaned toward her.
"How old are you, Harmon?"
13.
"You're the youngest person in the room. You can wait for a rating."
Beth was furious. "I want to play Beltic." The other man at the table spoke up.
"If you win your next 3 games, honey, and if Beltic does the same."
"I'll win them," Beth said.
"No, you won't, Harmon," the first young man said. "You'll have to play Sizemore and Goldman first, and you can't beat both of them."
"Sizemore and Goldman, shit," the other man said. "The guy you're playing now is underrated. He plays first board for the university team, and last month he came in 5th in Las Vegas. Don't let the rating fool you."
"What's in Las Vegas?" Beth asked.
"The U.S. Open."
Beth went to board 4. The man seated behind the white pieces was smiling as she came up. It was the tall, handsome one. Beth felt a bit rattled to see him. He looked like some kind of movie star.
"Hi, Harmon," he said, holding out his hand. "It looks like we've been stalking each other."
She shook his big hand awkwardly and seated herself. There was a pause for a long minute before he said,
"Do you want to start my clock?"
"Sorry," she said. She reached out to start it, almost knocked it over, but caught it in time. "Sorry," she said again, almost inaudibly. She pressed the button and his clock started ticking. She looked down at the board, her cheeks burning. He played pawn to king 4, and she replied with the Sicilian. He continued with book moves, and she followed with the dragon variation. They traded pawns in the center. Gradually, she got her composure back, playing these mechanical moves, and she looked across the board at him. He was attentive to the pieces, scowling. But even with a scowl on his face and his hair slightly mussed, he was handsome. Something in Beth's stomach felt strange as she looked at him, with his broad shoulders and clear complexion, and his brow wrinkled in concentration. He surprised her by bringing his queen out. It was a bold move, and she studied it for a while and saw that there wasn't any weakness to it. She brought out her own queen. He moved a knight to the fifth rank, and Beth moved a knight to the fifth rank. He checked with a bishop, and she defended with a pawn. He retreated the bishop. She was feeling light now, and her fingers with the pieces were nimble. Both players began moving fast but easily. She gave a non-threatening check to his king, and he pulled away delicately and began advancing pawns. She stopped that handily with a pin, and then feinted on the queen side with a rook. He was undeceived by the feint, and smiling, removed her pin, and on his next move, continued the pawn advances. She retreated, hiding her king in a queenside castle. She felt somehow spacious and amused, yet her face remained serious. They continued their dance. It made her sad, in a way, when she eventually saw how to beat him. It was after the 19th move, and she felt herself resisting it as it opened up in her mind, hating to let go of the pleasant ballet they had danced together. But there it was. 4 moves, and he would have to lose a rook, or worse. She hesitated, and made the first move of the sequence. He didn't see what was happening until 2 moves later, when he frowned suddenly and said, "Jesus Christ, Harmon, I'm going to drop a rook." She loved his voice. She loved the way he said it. He shook his head in mock bafflement. She loved that. Some players who had finished their game early had gathered around the board, and a couple were whispering about the maneuver Beth had brought off. Towns went on playing for 5 more moves, and Beth felt genuinely sorry for him when he resigned, tipping his king over and saying, "Damn." But he stood up, stretched and smiled down at her. "You're one hell of a chess player, Harmon," he said. "How old are you?"
13.
He whistled.
"Where do you go to school?"
"Fairfield Junior."
"Yeah," he said. "I know where that is."
He was even better looking than a movie star. An hour later, she drew Goldman and board 3. She walked into the tournament room at exactly 11, and the people standing stopped talking when she came in. Everyone looked at her. She heard someone whisper, "13 fucking years old." And immediately, the thought came into her mind, along with the exultant feeling the whispered voice had given her. "I could have done this at 8. Goldman was tough, and silent, and slow. He was a short, heavy man, and he played the black pieces like a gruff general trained in defense. For the first hour, everything that Beth tried, he got out of. Every piece he had was protected. It seemed as though there were double the usual complement of pawns to protect them. Beth got fidgety during the long waits for him to move. Once, after she had advanced a bishop, she got up and went to the bathroom. Something was hurting in her abdomen, and she felt a bit faint. She washed her face with cold water and dried it on a paper towel. As she was leaving, the girl she'd played her first game with came in. Packer. Packer looked glad to see her.
"You're moving right on up, aren't you?" she said.
"So far," Beth said, feeling another twinge in her belly.
"I heard you're playing Goldman."
"Yes," Beth said. "I have to get back."
"Sure," Packer said. Sure. Beat his ass, will you? Just beat his ass.
Suddenly, Beth grinned.
Okay, she said.
When she got back, she saw that Goldman had moved, and her clock was ticking. He sat there in his dark suit, looking bored. She felt refreshed and ready. She seated herself and put everything out of her mind except the 64 squares in front of her. After a minute, she saw that if she attacked on both flanks simultaneously, as Morphy did sometimes, Goldman would have difficulty playing it safe. She played pawn to queen rook 4. It worked. After 5 moves, she had opened his king up a little, and after 3 more, she was at his throat. She paid no attention to Goldman himself, or to the crowd, or to the feeling in her lower abdomen, or the sweat that had broken out on her brow. She played against the board only, with lines of force etched for her into its surface. The small, stubborn fields for the pawns, the enormous one for the queen, the gradations in between. Just before his clock was about to run out, she checkmated him. When she circled her name on the score sheet, she looked again at the number of Goldman's rating. It was 1997. People were applauding. She went directly to the girls' room and discovered that she had begun to menstruate. For a moment, she felt, looking at the redness in the water below her, as though something catastrophic had happened. Had she bled on the chair at board 3? Were the people there staring at the stains of her blood? But she saw with relief that her cotton panties were barely spotted. She thought abruptly of Jolene. If it hadn't been for Jolene, she would have had no idea what was happening. No one else had said a word about this, certainly not Mrs. Wheatley. She felt a sudden warmth for Jolene, remembering that Jolene had also told her what to do in an emergency. Beth began pulling a long sheet from the roll of toilet paper and folding it into a tightly packed rectangle. The pain in her abdomen had eased. She was menstruating, and she had just beaten Goldman, 1997. She put the folded paper into her panties, pulled them up tight, straightened her skirt, and walked confidently back into the playing area. Beth had seen Sizemore before. He was a small, ugly, thin-faced man who smoked cigarettes continuously. Someone had told her he was state champion before Beltic. Beth would play him on board 2 in the room with the sign reading Top Boards. Sizemore wasn't there yet, but next to her at board 1, Beltic was facing in her direction. Beth looked at him and then looked away. It was a few minutes before 3. The lights in this smaller room, bare bulbs under a metal protection basket, seemed brighter than those in the big room, brighter than they had been in the morning. And for a moment, the shine on the varnished floor with its painted red lines was blinding. Sizemore came in, combing his hair in a nervous, quick way. A cigarette hung from his thin lips. As he pulled his chair back, Beth felt herself becoming very tight.
Ready?
Sizemore asked gruffly, slipping the comb into his shirt pocket.
Yes, she said, and punched his clock.
He played pawn to king 4, and then pulled out his comb and started biting on it, the way a person bites on the eraser end of a pencil. Beth played pawn to queen bishop 4. By the middle game, Sizemore had begun combing his hair after each move. He hardly ever looked at Beth, but concentrated on the board, wriggling in his seat sometimes as he combed and parted and reparted his hair. The game was even, and there were no weaknesses on either side. There was nothing to do but find the best squares for her knights and bishops and wait. She would move, write the move down on her score sheet, and sit back in her chair. After a while, a crowd began to gather at the ropes. She glanced at them from time to time. There were more people watching her play than watching Beltic. She kept looking at the board, waiting for something to open up. Once, when she looked up, she saw Annette Packer standing at the back. Packer smiled, and Beth nodded to her. Back at the board, Sizemore brought a knight to Queen 5, posting it in the best place for a knight. Beth frowned. She couldn't dislodge it. The pieces were thick in the middle of the board, and for a moment, she lost the sense of them. There were occasional twinges in her abdomen. She could feel the thick batch of paper between her thighs. She adjusted herself in the chair and squinted at the board. This wasn't good. Sizemore was creeping up on her. She looked at his face. He had put away his comb and was looking at the pieces in front of him with satisfaction. Beth leaned over the table, digging her fists into her cheeks, and tried to penetrate the position. Some people in the crowd were whispering. With an effort, she drove distractions from her mind. It was time to fight back. If she moved the knight on the left, no. If she opened the long diagonal for her white bishop, that was it. She pushed the pawn up, and the bishop's power was tripled. The picture started to become clearer. She leaned back in her seat and took a deep breath. During the next 5 moves, Sizemore kept bringing pieces up. But Beth, seeing the limits to what he could do to her, kept her attention focused on the far left-hand corner of the board, on Sizemore's queen side. When the time came, she brought her bishop down in the middle of his clustered pieces there, setting it on his knight 2 square. From where it sat now, 2 of his pieces could capture it, but if either did, he would be in trouble. She looked at him. He had taken out his comb again and was running it through his hair. His clock was ticking. It took him 15 minutes to make the move, and when he did, it was a shock. He took the bishop with his rook. Didn't he know he was a fool to move the rook off the back rank? Couldn't he see that? She looked back at the board, double-checked the position, and brought out her queen. He didn't see it until the move after next, and his game fell apart. He still had his comb in his hand 6 moves later when she got her queen's pawn, passed to the 6th rank. He brought his rook under the pawn. She attacked it with her bishop. Sizemore stood up, put his comb in his pocket, reached down to the board and set his king on its side. "You win," he said grimly. The applause was thunderous. After she had turned in the score sheet, she waited while the young man checked it, made a mark on a list in front of him, stood up, and walked to the bulletin board. He took the pushpins from the card saying, "Sizemore," and threw the card in a green metal wastebasket. Then he pulled the pins out of the bottom card and raised it to where Sizemore's had been. The undefeated list now read, "Beltic, Harmon." When she was walking toward the girls' room, Beltic came out of top boards, striding fast and looking very pleased with himself. He was carrying the little score sheet, on his way to the winner's basket. He didn't seem to see Beth. She went over to the doorway of the top board's room, and Towns was standing there. There were lines of fatigue in his face. He looked like Rock Hudson, except for the weariness.
"Good work, Harmon," he said.
"I'm sorry you lost," she said.
"Yeah," he said. "It's back to the drawing board."
And then, nodding to where Beltic was standing at the front table with a small crowd gathered near him, he said,
"He's a killer, Harmon. A genuine killer."
She looked at his face. "You need a rest." He smiled down at her.
"What I need, Harmon,
is some of your talent.
As she passed the front table, Beltuk took a step toward her and said,
"Tomorrow."
When Beth came into the living room just before supper, Mrs. Wheatley looked pale and strange. She was sitting in the chintz armchair, and her face was puffy. She was holding a brightly colored postcard in her lap. "I've started menstruating," Beth said. Mrs. Wheatley blinked.
"That's nice," she said, as though from a great distance.
"I'll need some pads or something," Beth said. Mrs. Wheatley seemed nonplussed for a moment. Then she brightened.
"That's certainly a milepost for you. Why don't you just go up to my room and look in the top drawer of my chiffonier? Take all you require."
"Thank you," Beth said, heading for the stairs.
"And dear," Mrs. Wheatley said, "bring down that little bottle of green pills by my bedside."
When Beth came back, she gave the pills to Mrs. Wheatley. Mrs. Wheatley had half a glass of beer sitting beside her. She took out two of the pills and swallowed them with the beer.
"My tranquility needs to be refurbished," she said.
"Is something wrong?" Beth asked.
"I'm not Aristotle," Mrs. Wheatley said, "but it could be construed as wrong. I have received a message from Mr. Wheatley."
"What did he say?"
"Mr. Wheatley has been indefinitely detained in the Southwest. The American Southwest."
"Oh," Beth said.
"Between Denver and Butte."
Beth sat down on the sofa.
"Aristotle was a moral philosopher," Mrs. Wheatley said, "while I am a housewife, or was a housewife."
"Can't they send me back if you don't have a husband?"
"You put it concretely," Mrs. Wheatley sipped her beer. "They won't if we lie about it."
"That's easy enough," Beth said.
"You're a good soul, Beth," Mrs. Wheatley said, finishing her beer. "Why don't you heat the 2 chicken dinners in the freezer? Set the oven at 400.
Beth had been holding 2 sanitary napkins in her right hand. "I don't know how to put these on." Mrs. Wheatley straightened herself up from her slumped position in the chair.
"I am no longer a wife," she said, "except by legal fiction. I believe I can learn to be a mother. I'll show you how if you promise me never to go near Denver."
During the night, Beth woke to hear rain on the roof over her head and intermittent rattling against the panes of her dormer windows. She had been dreaming of water, of herself swimming easily in a quiet ocean of still water. She put a pillow over her head and curled up on her side, trying to get back to sleep. But she could not. The rain was loud, and as it continued to fall, the sad languor of her dream was replaced by the image of a chessboard filled with pieces demanding her attention, demanding the clarity of her intelligence. It was 2 in the morning, and she did not get back to sleep for the rest of the night. It was still raining when she went downstairs at 7. The backyard outside the kitchen window looked like a swamp, with hillocks of near-dead grass sticking up like islands. She was not certain how to fry eggs, but decided she could boil some. She got 2 from the refrigerator, filled a pan with water, and put it on the burner. She would play pawn to king 4 against him, and hope for the Sicilian. She boiled the eggs 5 minutes and put them in cold water. She could see Beltic's face, youthful, arrogant, and smart. His eyes were small and black. When he stepped toward her yesterday as she was leaving, some part of her had thought he would hit her. The eggs were perfect. She opened them with a knife, put them in a cup, and ate them with salt and butter. Her eyes were grainy under the lids. The final game would begin at 11. It was 7:20 now. She wished she had a copy of Modern Chess Openings to look over variations on the Sicilian. Some of the other players at the tournament had carried battered copies of the book under their arms. It was only drizzling when she left the house at 10, and Mrs. Wheatley was still upstairs asleep. Before she left, Beth went into the bathroom and checked the sanitary belt Mrs. Wheatley had given her to wear, and the thick white pad. It was all right. She put on her galoshes and her blue coat, got Mrs. Wheatley's umbrella from the closet, and left. She had noticed before that the pieces at board one were different. They were solid wooden ones like Mr. Gans's, and not the hollow plastic pieces that sat on the other boards at the tournament. When she walked by the table in the empty room at 10:30, she reached out and picked up the white king. It was satisfyingly heavy, with a solid lead weight and green felt on the bottom. She placed the piece on its home square, stepped back over the velvet rope, and walked to the girls' room. She washed her face for the third time that day, tightened her sanitary belt, combed her bangs, and went back to the gymnasium. More players had come in. She stuffed her hands into the pockets of her skirt so that no one could see they were trembling. When 11 o'clock came, she was ready behind the white pieces at board one. Boards two and three had already started their games. Sizemore was at board two. She didn't recognize the others. 10 minutes passed, and Beltic did not appear. The tournament director in the white shirt climbed over and stood near Beth for a minute.
"Hasn't shown yet,"
he said softly. Beth shook her head.
"Make your move and punch the clock," the director whispered. "You should have done it at 11.
That annoyed her. No one had told her about that. She moved pawn to king four and started Beltic's clock. It was 10 more minutes before Beltic came in. Beth's stomach hurt, and her eyes smarted. Beltic looked casual and relaxed, wearing a bright red shirt and tan corduroy pants.
"Sorry," he said in a normal voice. "Extra cup of coffee."
The other players looked over at him with irritation. Beth said nothing. Beltic, still standing, loosened an extra button on his shirt front and held out his hand.
"Harry Beltic," he said. "What's your name?"
He must know what her name was.
"I'm Beth Harmon," she said, taking his hand but avoiding his eyes.
He seated himself behind the black pieces, rubbed his hands together briskly, and moved his king pawn to the third square. He punched Beth's clock smartly. The French defense. She had never played it. She didn't like the look of it. The thing to do was play pawn to queen four. But what happened if he played the same? Did she trade pawns or push one of them forward, or bring out her knight? She squinted and shook her head. It was difficult to picture what the board would look like after the moves. She looked again, rubbed her eyes, and played pawn to queen four. When she reached out to punch the clock, she hesitated. Had she made a mistake? But it was too late now. She pressed the button hastily, and as it clicked down, Beltic immediately picked up his queen pawn, put it on queen four, and slapped down the button on his clock. Although it was difficult to see with her usual clarity, she had not lost her sense of the requirements of an opening. She brought out her knights and involved herself for a while in a struggle for the center squares. But Beltic, moving fast, nipped off one of her pawns, and she saw that she couldn't capture the pawn he did it with. She tried to shrug off the advantage she'd allowed and went on playing. She got her pieces off the back rank and castled. She looked over the board at Beltic. He seemed completely at ease. He was looking at the game going on next to them. Beth felt a knot in her stomach. She could not get comfortable in her seat. The heavy cluster of pieces and pawns in the center of the board seemed for a while to have no pattern, to make no sense. Her clock was ticking. She inclined her head to look at its face. 25 minutes were gone, and she was still down by a pawn. And Beltic had used only 22 minutes altogether, even including the time he'd wasted by being late. There was a ringing in her ears, and the bright light in the room hurt her eyes. Beltic was leaning back with his arms outstretched, yawning, showing the black places on the undersides of his teeth. She found what looked like a good square for her knight, reached out her hand, and then stopped. The move would be terrible. Something had to be done about his queen before he had it on the rook file and was ready to threaten. She had to protect and attack at the same time, and she couldn't see how. The pieces in front of her just sat there. She should have taken a green pill last night to make her sleep. Then she saw a move that looked sensible and quickly made it. She brought a knight back near the king, protecting herself against Beltic's queen. He raised his eyebrows almost imperceptibly and immediately took a pawn on the other side of the board. There was suddenly a diagonal open for his bishop. The bishop was aimed at the knight she'd wasted time bringing back, and she was down by another pawn. At the corner of Beltic's mouth was a sly little smile. She quickly looked away from his face, frightened. She had to do something. He would be all over her king in 4 or 5 moves. She needed to concentrate to see it clearly. But when she looked at the board, everything was dense, interlocked, complicated, dangerous. Then she thought of something to do. With her clock still running, she stood up, stepped over the rope, and walked through the small crowd of silent spectators to the main gym floor, and across it to the girls' room. There was no one there. She went to a sink, washed her face with cold water, wet a handful of paper towels and held them for a minute to the back of her neck. After she threw them away, she went into one of the little stalls and, sitting, checked her sanitary napkin. It was okay. She sat there, relaxing, letting her mind go blank. Her elbows were on her knees, her head was bent down. With an effort of will, she made the chessboard with the game on board 1 on it appear in front of her. There it was. She could see immediately that it was difficult, but not as difficult as some of the games she'd memorized from the book at Morris's bookstore. The pieces before her, in her imagination, were crisp and sharply focused. She stayed where she was, not worrying about time, until she had it penetrated and understood. Then she got up, washed her face again, and walked back into the gym. She had found her move. There were more people gathered in top boards than before. As games ended, they came in to watch the finals. She pushed by them, stepped over the rope, and sat down. Her hands were perfectly steady, and her stomach and eyes felt fine. She reached out and moved. She punched the clock firmly. Beltic studied the move for a few minutes and took her knight with his bishop, as she knew he would. She did not retake. She brought a bishop over to attack one of his rooks. He moved the rook, the button down on his clock, leaned back in his chair and drew a deep breath. "It doesn't work," Beth said. "I don't have to take the queen." "Move," Beltic said. "I'll check you first with the bishop." "Move." She nodded and checked with the bishop. Beltic, with his clock ticking, quickly moved his king away and pressed the button. Then Beth did what she had planned all along. She brought her queen crashing down next to the king, sacrificing it. Beltic looked at her, stunned. She stared back at him. He shrugged, snatched up the queen, and stopped his clock by hitting it with the base of the captured piece. Beth pushed her other bishop from the back rank out to the middle of the board and said,
"Check.
Mate, next move."
Beltic stared at it for a moment, said, "Son of a bitch," and stood up.
"The rook mates," Beth said.
"Son of a bitch," Beltic said.
The crowd that had now filled the room began applauding. Beltic, still scowling, held out his hand, and Beth shook it.
5. They were ready to close by the time she got to the teller. She'd had to wait for the bus after school and wait again transferring down Main, and this was the second bank. She'd carried the folded check in her blouse pocket all day, under the sweater. It was in her hand when the man in front of her picked up his rolls of nickels and stuffed them in the pocket of his overcoat and left the space at the window for her. She set her hand on the cold marble, holding the check out and standing on tiptoe, to be able to see the face of the teller.
"I'd like to open an account," Beth said. The man glanced at the check.
"How old are you, miss?"
13.
"I'm sorry," he said. "You'll need a parent or guardian with you."
Beth put the check back in her blouse pocket and left. At the house, Mrs. Wheatley had 4 empty Pabst Blue Ribbon beer bottles sitting on the little table by her chair. The TV was off. Beth had picked up the afternoon paper from the front porch. She unfolded it as she came into the living room.
"How was school, dear?"
Mrs. Wheatley's voice was dim and far away.
"It was okay."
As Beth set the newspaper on the green plastic hassock by the sofa, she saw with quiet astonishment that her own picture was printed on the front page, at the bottom. Near the top was the face of Nikita Khrushchev, and at the bottom, one column wide, was her face, scowling beneath a headline, "Local Prodigy Takes Chess Tourney." Under this, in smaller letters, bold face, 12-year-old astonishes experts. She remembered the man taking her picture before they gave her the trophy and the check. She had told him she was 13. Beth bent over, reading the paper. The world of Kentucky chess was astonished this weekend by the playing of a local girl who triumphed over hardened players to win the Kentucky State Championship. Elizabeth Harmon, a 7th-grade student at Fairfield Junior, showed a mastery of the game unequaled by any female, according to Harry Beltic, whom Miss Harmon defeated for the state crown. Beth grimaced. She hated the picture of herself. It showed her freckles and her small nose all too clearly.
"I want to open a bank account," she said.
"A bank account?"
"You'll have to go with me."
"But my dear," Mrs. Wheatley said, "what would you open a bank account with?"
Beth reached into her blouse pocket, took out the check, and handed it to her. Mrs. Wheatley sat up in her chair and held the check in her hand as though it were a Dead Sea Scroll. She was silent for a moment, reading it. Then she said softly,
$100.
"I need a parent or guardian at the bank."
$100, Mrs. Wheatley said. "Then you won it?"
"Yes, it says first place on the check."
"I see," Mrs. Wheatley said. "I hadn't the foggiest idea people made money playing chess."
"Some tournaments have bigger prizes than that."
"Goodness!"
Mrs. Wheatley was still staring at the check.
"We can go to the bank after school tomorrow."
"Certainly,"
Mrs. Wheatley said. The next day, when they came into the living room after the bank, there was a copy of Chess Review on the cobbler's bench in front of the sofa. Mrs. Wheatley hung her coat in the hall closet and picked up the magazine.
While you were at school, she said, I was leafing through this. I see there's a major tournament in Cincinnati the second week in December. First prize is $500.
Beth studied her for a long moment. I have to be in school then, she said, and Cincinnati's pretty far from here.
The Greyhound bus requires only 2 hours for the trip, Mrs. Wheatley said. I took the liberty of calling.
What about school? Beth said.
I can write a medical excuse claiming mono.
Mono?
Mononucleosis. It's quite the thing in your age group, according to the Ladies' Home Journal.
Beth kept looking at her, trying not to let the astonishment show in her face. Mrs. Wheatley's dishonesty seemed in every way to match her own. Then she said, Where would we stay?
At the Gibson Hotel, in a double room at $22 a night. The Greyhound tickets will be $11.80 apiece, and there will, of course, be the cost of food. I have calculated all of it. Even if you win second or third prize, there will be a profit.
Beth had $20 in cash and a packet of 10 checks in her plastic purse.
I need to buy some chess books, she said. By all means, Mrs. Wheatley said, smiling. And if you'll make out a check for $23.60, I'll get the bus tickets tomorrow.
After buying modern chess openings and a book on the endgame at Morris's, Beth walked across the street to Purcell's department store. She knew from the way girls talked at school that Purcell's was better than Ben Snyder's. She found what she wanted on the fourth floor, a wooden set, almost identical to the one Mr. Gans owned, with hand-carved knights and big substantial pawns and rooks that were fat and solid. She was undecided for a while over the board and almost bought a wooden one, before settling on a folding linen board with green and beige squares. It would be more portable than the other. Back home, she cleared off her desk, put the board on it, and set up the pieces. She piled her new chess books on one side and placed the tall silver trophy in the shape of a chess king on the other. She turned on her student lamp and sat at the desk, just looking at the pieces, at the way their curves picked up the light. She sat for what seemed like a long time, her mind quiet. Then she picked up Modern Chess Openings. This time, she began at the beginning. She had never seen anything like the Gibson Hotel before. Its size and bustle, the bright chandeliers in its lobby, the heavy red carpeting, the flowers, even the three revolving doors and the uniformed doorman who stood beside them were overwhelming. She and Mrs. Wheatley walked up to the front of the hotel from the bus station, carrying their new luggage. Mrs. Wheatley refused to hand it over to the doorman. She lugged her suitcase up to the front desk and registered for them both, unperturbed by the look the room clerk gave them. In the room afterward, Beth began to relax. There were two big windows overlooking 4th Street with its rush-hour traffic. It was a crisp, cold day outside. Inside, they had this thick carpeted room with the big white bathroom and fluffy red towels and a huge plate-glass mirror covering one wall. There was a color TV on the dresser and a bright red bedspread on each of the beds. Mrs. Wheatley was inspecting the room, checking the dresser drawers, clicking the TV on and off, patting away a wrinkle on the bedspread. Well, she said, I asked them for a pleasant room, and I believe they gave it to me. She seated herself in the high-backed Victorian chair by her bed, as though she had lived in the Gibson Hotel all her life. The tournament was on the mezzanine in the Taft Room. All Beth had to do was take the elevator. Mrs. Wheatley found them a diner down the street where they had bacon and eggs for breakfast. Then she went back to bed with a copy of the Cincinnati Enquirer
and a pack of Chesterfields while Beth went down to the tournament and registered. She still did not have a rating, but this time one of the men at the desk knew who she was. They didn't try to put her in the beginner's section. There would be two games a day, and the time control would be 1:20:40, which meant you had 2 hours to make 40 moves. While she was signing in, she could hear a deep voice coming through one of the double doors that stood open to the Taft room, where the games would be. She looked that way and saw part of the big ballroom, with a long row of empty tables and a few men walking around. When she walked in, she saw a strange man slouched on a sofa, with black booted feet resting on a coffee table.
"And the rook comes to the 7th rank," he was saying. "Bone in the throat, man, that rook there. He took one look at it and paid up."
He leaned his head against the back of the sofa and laughed loudly in a deep baritone.
$20.
Since it was early, there were only half a dozen people in the room, and no one was at the long rows of tables with paper chessboards on them. Everyone was listening to the man talking. He was about 25 and looked like a pirate. He wore dirty jeans, a black turtleneck, and a black wool cap pulled down to his heavy eyebrows. He had a thick black mustache and clearly needed a shave. The backs of his hands were tanned and scraped-looking.
"The Karokan Defense," he said, laughing. "A genuine bummer." "What's wrong with the Karokan?"
someone asked, a neat young man in a camel's hair sweater.
"All pawns and no hope."
He lowered his legs to the floor and sat up. On the table was a soiled old beige and green chessboard with battered wooden pieces on it. The head had fallen off the Black King at some time or another. It was held on with a piece of gritty adhesive tape.
"I'll show you,"
the man said, sliding the board over. Beth was now standing next to him. She was the only girl in the room. The man reached down to the board and, with surprising delicacy, picked up the white king pawn with his fingertips and dropped it lightly on king 4. Then he picked up the black queen bishop pawn and dropped it on queen's bishop 3, put white's queen pawn on the 4th rank, and did the same with black's. He looked up at the people around him, who were by now all paying close attention.
"The Karokan, right?"
Beth was familiar with these moves, but she had never seen them played. She expected the man to move the white queen's knight next, and he did. Then he had the black pawn capture the white, and took the capturing pawn with the white knight. He played black's king knight to bishop 3, and brought white's other knight out. Beth remembered the move. Looking at it now, it seemed tame. She found herself speaking up.
"I'd take the knight," she said quietly.
The man looked at her and raised his eyebrows.
"Aren't you that kid from Kentucky? The one who wiped out Harry Beltic?"
"Yes," Beth said. "If you take the knight, it doubles his pawns."
"Big deal," the man said. "All pawns and no hope. Here's how to win with black."
He left the knight in the center of the board and played black's pawn to king 4. Then he continued laying out the moves of a game, shuffling the pieces around on the board with casual dexterity, occasionally pointing out a potential trap. The game built to a balanced fugue in the center. It was like time-lapse photography on TV, where a pale green stalk humps itself from dirt, heightens, swells, and explodes into a peony or a rose. Some other people had come into the room and were watching. Beth was feeling a new kind of excitement with this display, with the knowingness, the clarity and nerve of the man in the black cap. He began trading pieces in the center, lifting the captured ones off the board with his fingertips as though they were dead flies, keeping up a soft-voiced patter that pointed out necessities and weaknesses, pitfalls, and strengths. Once, when he had to reach across the board to the back rank and move a rook from its home square, she was astonished to see as he stretched his body that he was carrying a knife at his waist. The leather and metal handle protruded above his belt. He looked so much like someone out of Treasure Island that the knife did not seem at all out of place. Just then, he paused in his moving and said,
"Now watch this,"
and brought the black rook up to its King 5 square, setting it down with a muted flourish. He folded his arms across his chest.
"What does White do here?"
he asked, looking around him. Beth considered the board. There were pitfalls all over for White. One of the men watching spoke up.
"Queen takes pawn?"
The man in the cap shook his head, smiling.
"Rook to King 8, check, and the queen falls."
Beth had seen that. It looked to be all over for the white pieces, and she started to say so, when another man spoke up.
"That's Mrs. Reshevsky, from the 30s.
The man looked up at him.
"You've got it," he said. "Margate, 1935. "White played rook to queen 1,
the first man said.
"Right," said the other. "What else has he got?"
He made the move and continued. It was clear now that White was losing. There were some fast trades and then an endgame that looked for a moment as though it might be slow. But Black made a striking sacrifice of a passed pawn, and abruptly, the topology of pawn queening made it clear that Black would have a queen 2 moves before White. It was a dazzling game, like some of the best ones Beth had learned from books. The man stood up, took off his cap, and stretched. He looked down at Beth for a moment.
"Reshevsky was playing like that when he was your age, little girl. Younger."
Back in the room, Mrs. Wheatley was still reading the Inquirer. She looked over her reading glasses at Beth as she came in the door.
"Finished already?" she said.
"Yes."
"How did you do?"
"I won."
Mrs. Wheatley smiled warmly.
"Honey," she said, "you are a treasure."
Mrs. Wheatley had seen an ad about a sale at Shillitoe's, a department store a few blocks from the Gibson. Since there were 4 hours before Beth's next game, they went over, through lightly falling snow, and Mrs. Wheatley rummaged in the basement a while, until Beth said,
"I'd like to take a look at their sweaters."
"What kind of sweaters, dear?"
"Cashmere."
Mrs. Wheatley's eyebrows went up.
"Cashmere? Are you sure we can afford it?"
"Yes."
Beth found a pale gray sweater on sale for $24, and it fit her perfectly. Looking in the tall mirror, she tried to imagine herself as a member of the Apple Pie Club, like Margaret. But the face was still Beth's face, rounded and freckled, with straight brown hair. She shrugged and bought the sweater with a traveler's check. They had passed an elegant little shoe store with saddle Oxfords in the window on the way to Shillitoe's, and she took Mrs. Wheatley there and bought herself a pair. Then she bought Argyle socks to go with them. The tag said 100% wool, made in England. Going back to the hotel through a wind that whipped tiny snowflakes against her, Beth kept looking down at her new shoes and high plaid socks. She liked the way her feet felt, liked the tightness of the warm socks against her calves, and liked the way they looked. Bright, expensive socks above bright brown and white shoes. She kept looking down. That afternoon, she was matched with a middle-aged Ohioan, with a rating of 1910. She played the Sicilian and forced him to resign after an hour and a half. Her mind was as clear as it had ever been, and she was able to use some of the things she had learned over the past weeks from studying her new book by the Russian master Boleslavsky. When she turned in her score sheet, Sizemore was standing near the desk. She saw a few other familiar faces from that tournament, and it felt good to see them. But she really wanted to see only one player from before. Towns. She looked several times, but didn't find him. Back in their room that evening, Mrs. Wheatley watched the Beverly Hillbillies and the Dick Van Dyke Show, while Beth set up and went over her two games, looking for weaknesses in her play. There weren't any. Then she got out the book by Reuben Fine on endgames and began studying. The endgame in chess had its own feeling. It was like an altogether different contest, once you got down to a piece or two on each side, and the question became one of queening a pawn. It could be agonizingly subtle. There was no chance for the kind of violent attack Beth loved. But she was bored with Reuben Fine, and after a while she closed the book and went to bed. She had two of the little green pills in her pajama pocket, and she took them after the lights were off. She didn't want to risk not sleeping. The second day was as easy as the first, even though Beth was matched against stronger players. It had taken her a while to clear her head from the effect of the pills, but by the time she started playing, her mind was sharp. She even handled the pieces themselves with confidence, picking them up and setting them down with aplomb. There was no top boards room at this tournament. Board one was merely the first board at the first table. For the second game, Beth was at board six, and people were gathered around her as she forced the master to resign after taking one of his rooks. When she looked up, during the applause, there stood Alma Wheatley at the back of the room smiling broadly. In her final game, at board one, Beth was playing a master named Rudolph. He managed to start trading pieces in the center during the middle game, and Beth was alarmed to find herself crowded into an ending with a rook, a knight, and three pawns. Rudolph had the same thing, except for a bishop, where she had a knight. She didn't like it, and his bishop was a distinct advantage. But she managed to pin it, and trade her knight for it, and then play with great care for an hour and a half, until Rudolph made a blunder, and she zeroed in on it. She checked with a pawn, traded rooks, and got one of her pawns passed with the king protecting. Rudolph looked furious at himself and resigned. There was strong applause. Beth looked at the crowd around the table. Near the back, in her blue dress, was Mrs. Wheatley, clapping her hands enthusiastically. Going back to the room, Mrs. Wheatley carried the heavy trophy, and Beth had the check in her blouse pocket. Mrs. Wheatley had written it all out on a sheet of hotel stationery that sat on top of the TV. $66 for 3 days at the Gibson, plus $3.30 tax, $23.60 for the bus, and the price of each meal, including tip. I've allowed $12 for our celebration supper tonight, and $2 for a small breakfast tomorrow. That makes our total expenses equal $172.30. It leaves over $300, Beth said. There was a silence for a while. Beth looked at the sheet of paper, although she understood it perfectly well. She was wondering if she should offer to split the money with Mrs. Wheatley. She did not want to do that. She had won it herself. Mrs. Wheatley broke the silence. Perhaps you could give me 10%, she said pleasantly, as an agent's commission. $32, Beth said, and 77 cents. They told me at Methuen that you were marvelous at math. Beth nodded. Okay, she said. They had something with veal in it at an Italian restaurant. Mrs. Wheatley ordered herself a carafe of red wine and drank it and smoked Chesterfields throughout the meal. Beth liked the bread and the cold, pale butter. She liked the little tree with oranges on it that sat at the bar, not far from their table. Mrs. Wheatley wiped her chin with her napkin when she finished the wine and lit a final cigarette.
"Beth, dear," she said, "there's a tournament in Houston over the holidays, starting the 26th. I understand it's very easy to travel on Christmas Day, since most people are eating plum pudding or whatever."
"I saw," Beth said. She had read the ad in Chess Review and wanted very much to go. But Houston had seemed awfully far away for a $600 prize.
"I believe we could fly to Houston," Mrs. Wheatley said brightly. "We could have a pleasant winter vacation in the sun."
Beth was finishing her spumoni. "Okay," she said, and then looking down at the ice cream. "Okay, Mother."
Their Christmas dinner was microwave turkey served on an airplane, with a complimentary glass of champagne for Mrs. Wheatley and canned orange juice for Beth. It was the best Christmas she had ever had. The plane flew over a snow-covered Kentucky, and at the end of the trip, circled out above the Gulf of Mexico. They landed in warm air and sunshine. Driving in from the airport, they passed one construction site after the other, the big yellow cranes and bulldozers standing idle near stacks of girders. Someone had hung a Christmas wreath on one of them. A week before they left Lexington, a new copy of Chess Review had come in the mail. When Beth opened it, she found a small picture of herself and Beltic at the back, and a banner headline, "Schoolgirl Takes Kentucky Championship from Master." Their game was printed, and the commentary said, "Onlookers were amazed at her youthful mastery of the fine points of strategy. She shows the assurance of players twice her age." She read it twice before showing it to Mrs. Wheatley. Mrs. Wheatley was ecstatic. She had read the article in the Lexington paper aloud and then said, "Wonderful." This time, she read in silence before saying, "This is national recognition, dear," in a hushed voice. Mrs. Wheatley had brought the magazine with her, and they spent part of the time on the plane marking the tournaments Beth would play over the next several months. They settled on one a month. Mrs. Wheatley was afraid they would run out of diseases and, as she said, credibility, if she wrote more excuses than that. Beth wondered to herself if they shouldn't just ask for permission in a straightforward way. After all, boys were allowed to miss classes for basketball and football. But she was wise enough to say nothing. Mrs. Wheatley seemed to take immense enjoyment in doing it this way. It was like a conspiracy. She won in Houston without any trouble. She was, as Mrs. Wheatley said, really getting the hang of it. She was forced to draw her third game, but took the final one by a dazzling combination, beating the 40-year-old Southwest champion as though he were a beginner. They stayed over 2 days for the sun and visited the Museum of Fine Arts and the Zoological Gardens. On the day after the tournament, Beth's picture was in the paper, and this time it made her feel good to see it. The article called her a wunderkind. Mrs. Wheatley bought 3 copies, saying, "I just might start a scrapbook." In January, Mrs. Wheatley called the school to say that Beth had a relapse of mono, and they went to Charleston. In February, it was Atlanta and a cold. In March, Miami and the flu. Sometimes Mrs. Wheatley talked to the assistant principal, and sometimes to the dean of girls. No one questioned the excuses. It seemed likely that some of the students knew about her from out-of-town papers or something, but no one in authority said anything. Beth worked on her chess for 3 hours every evening between tournaments. She lost one game in Atlanta, but still came in first, and she stayed undefeated in the other 2 cities. She enjoyed flying with Mrs. Wheatley, who sometimes